Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirk the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day. And today, I am broadcasting live, but I'm not in my usual location. I'm not in the den. I'm out walking. I'm following the River Wye in the Wye Valley. I'm on holiday. And this is the famous place between Wales and England, Welsh Marches, as they're known, owned by the Norman Barons, who would pick a fight with anyone. Place of great beauty and great stories. Currently, I'm playing in two campaigns that are set in this area. Ars Magica, there's Dark Daily Coven, somewhere in this valley, where our burgeoning magi are setting up store. And also, this river, this beautiful river that's by the side of me, on my left, is it's a really polluted river. So in our Unknown Army game, we are fighting the dark forces that are conspiring to pollute it. It's a great place of story. I've had a great week here, just relaxing with family, reading up on games. And July is International Fanzine Month, so I've been playing around with fanzines. I've been making little fanzines for my own amusement whilst I've been away. And in this episode, we return to the subject of fanzines and joined in the Zoom role-playing rambling with Nick Edwards. And Nick was a fanzine editor back in the day, and he's come back to it. He's got his own fanzine, which he'll talk about, reviving some of the spirit of those UK fanzines. Me and Blindy get together, our resident rules lawyer, and we talk about going back into 1983, some unfinished business from a couple of episodes ago, where we're looking at some of the letters that are coming to the postbag from 1983 and responding to them. Anyway, that's enough for me. I need to just check the map. I think I'm going in the wrong direction. Anyway, I'll be back at the end with some parish notices. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling. I really am rambling this time.
Open Box.
Welcome to Open Box, the part of the podcast where we look backwards to look forwards, how our gaming of the past has influenced the gamers that we are today. I'm joined in the Zoom of role-playing rambling by zine editor at large, Grog Squadder, 12-sided dice blogger, Nick Edwards. Hello there, Nick.
Hello, Dirk. It's very strange hearing those words that I've listened to so often sort of attached to me and my name. This is quite weird. And yeah, I try not to get too starstruck.
No, I was very starstruck when I first heard of you because, of course, you were a zine editor back in the day.
It was quite a minor zine, although I made it seem maybe more than it was by keeping changing the name. So I actually co-edited, I think, four or five in the end. It felt like it was over the course of years, but actually I think it was basically pretty much 84 and 85 and 86, and the whole sort of zine hobby that I was involved in was actually quite a short period of time.
So just talk us through how you first got into it. So how did you first encounter it? And how did it fit into the gamer that you were back then?
Yeah, so I sort of discovered D&D when I was about 9. I remember like running a game in my primary school classroom. I can sort of picture it. So I know it was before I went to secondary school. My brother's mate, who lived in a pub over the road, and he had D&D, so he sort of introduced us. It's why I always associate role-playing with like the smell of stale beer on a weekend, you know, because you'd be... In those days, pubs were barely open compared to now. So we had the whole run of the place and played D&D. And it was in Bristol, or rather I lived in the countryside outside of Bristol, but the big game store or the local game store was Forever People, that some people who are from that area of the Southwest might remember, in the centre of Bristol. And it was like one of these subversive comic shops that sort of got into role-playing. And it must be that they started stocking fanzines. I can't really think how I would have come across fanzines otherwise. So I suspect they had like Dragon Lords, which was the sort of big one. And that would have been in like, Dragon Lords kicked off in, I think, 1980. And I would have been knocking around Forever People in like 1982. So I suspect I was sort of bought that then. And then, of course, they would have fanzine reviews of other fanzines. And then you start to, you know, things pick up momentum. You start to buy others.
Forever People, I remember from the adverts in Starburst magazine. I think they used to appear in the back of there.
Yeah, they had like a lot of those game stores. You sort of remember them by their adverts. But it's obviously it's got well long gone now. But it was a great place to, because you know you just go in there as a 12 or 13 year old and you just wanted everything. You know,
I should say as well that you've just started editing a fanzine that you launched probably back end of the last year and started this year, Torchbound. And within there, you've been going back and reading some of your back issues of these fanzines that you picked up back in the day. So you mentioned Dragon Lords, and that's one of the ones that you've started looking at again. So what was that like returning to Dragon Lords?
Yeah, so I suppose it was, so like, if I can give you a little bit of context, a little bit, sort of indulge me with a little bit of history, because I was thinking about where it came from. So in some ways, like if you take Alarums and Excursions, that sort of US fanzine, the very first of them that just celebrated 50 years actually this year and has just finished. But about, and I was looking through the first, I bought the PDFs off Lee Gold of the first 50 issues, and about maybe 15, 20 issues in, they started getting the odd contribution from British people for the first time. So there's a guy called Hartley Patterson who edited News from Bree, which is like a Tolkien fanzine that got into D&D. This is before Dragon, let alone White Dwarf. And so he started contributing to it and mentioning News from Bree. And then Brian Ansell started contributing to it and said, oh, you know, I'm just going to start my own fanzine, the first British fanzine, which is Troll Crusher. And then there was a few others, Beholder, Underworld Oracle. And they were all quite, in retrospect, so I've bought them on eBay. I didn't keep very much from when I was a kid, but you look at them now and they're really quite dull. You know, you've got, you know, silly character classes that you'd never use and quite staid dungeons and monsters. Great then, but in retrospect, they're a bit dry. That was like 77, 78, 79. And then Dragon Lords came out in 1980 and was completely, it wasn't completely different in terms of content. It's still had dungeons and character classes and monsters, and it was running kind of quite sort of conventional stuff really all the way through its life. But it had this completely different tone. Almost immediately it started not just making fun of like TSR and Gary Gygax and Ian Livingstone, which was kind of what you'd expect, although no one had really done that, even that before. But it started making really kind of pugilistic kind of style against other fanzine editors and just the kind of world at large. So it really kind of set a completely new, reading it back now, it was completely different than anything had come before. And it had this, and I wrote about this in Torchbound, so I'm trying to think what made it stand out. I had these three editors, Ian Marsh, Mike Lewis, and Mark Gascoigne, and they're really kind of, they were friends, but they were completely different kind of people. And I don't know them, I just know them through the pages of Dragon Lords. So you had Mike, who was very kind of steady and nice and just wanted everybody to be happy. And Ian was like really into gaming, but very sharp and quite, didn't take shit from anybody. And then Mark Gascoigne, who was just sort of looking for a fight constantly with the hobby in general. So you had this kind of real tonal sort of waves going through the magazine every time, because they'd edit different bits. And that was almost like a second era of fanzines all in one place. And again, looking at how it evolved over time, they introduced like a letters page, proper letters page for the first time, and then fanzine reviews kind of for the first time. And they started printing the addresses of people. And it's like, well, actually, suddenly, when you've got a letters page and you've got fanzine reviews with people's addresses and you've got subscriber addresses, you suddenly kind of got a hobby, because people can write to each other and you get to know each other. And you saw in like from like sort of 82, 83 onwards, all these people had obviously read Dragon Lords. And by that time, you know, it was quite, I don't know how many they were printing, maybe presumably more than 500. Starting their own fanzines. And, you know, somebody would start a fanzine, they get their mates to contribute to it. And then the contributors would start their own fanzine. So you had this like, big explosion, kind of modeled on Dragon Lords in a sense of being a mixture of kind of sort of hardware stuff, like dungeons and stuff, but also increasing amounts of chat about themselves and about each other. And again, that weird mix of, well, we're kind of all in this hobby together, but actually we're kind of, it becomes a bit factional and a bit cliquey and different sides take account. So you had sort of Dragon Lords, in summary, you had Dragon Lords like, to my mind, like start the hobby almost in the form of fanzines, bringing people together in a way that there wasn't really anything else out there. But also at the same time, kind of the seeds of its doom were implanted because everyone's just started being really horrible to each other. So it was kind of and you can see that through the fanzines over the course of actually what in retrospect is only a few years.
The reason recently I was thinking of how, as you say, compared with some of the other fanzines and magazines at the time, it was kind of irreverent. And I wondered how much of that irreverence was influenced by things like Smash Hits, which also had interjections from the editor in the reviews. And I think you make the point that Ian Marsh actually typed it. So from time to time, the kind of balanced reviews were kind of interjected by another voice, contradicting some of the things that were in there.
That's right. And because they took it in turns, I got the sense of between different issues, some people might do more of the typing. So you'd get these, as you say, you'd get these little editorial voices intruding kind of William Burroughs style into other people's writing. And you knew who they were, you know, just by their kind of, because they're, you knew it was Mark typing or Ian typing just based on the kinds of things they were saying. And they were so, they were so rude to each other. I mean, these are, you know, I suppose they started it in their late teens. So they were kind of doing it in their early 20s. So it was very, you know, I was just, waiting for the link to come through, I just literally opened Thunderstruck, which was another fanzine at kind of at random. This is one that came out quite soon after Dragon Lords, and just the letters column. And they'd done an interview with Gary Gygax, and this is just to show you a different tone. There's a letter from Mike Lewis. So I felt that you could have done much more with the Gary Gygax interview than you did. Perhaps you should have probed much deeper about some things. I don't know. And then Mark Gascoigne, your introduction was rubbish and proves to me at least what Mike was saying about how you cannot write. Your style will be parody when not so seriously and slavishly imitative and pretentious. And that's just, you know, like this is a random fanzine. And that just classic style of Dragon Lords, which was just this mix. I mean, I don't think you could have taken a zine worth of Mark Gascoigne or a zine worth of Mike Lewis. But together it was this kind of lovely mix.
And you mentioned Alarms and Excursions, which is something I've still not quite got my head around how the AEP actually works. It's kind of multiple contributions. It's like a collage of different zines, really, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, so, and it came out of, because one of the things that interests me and some of the things I talk about and talks about is not original, but the sort of differences between the UK hobby and the US hobby, particularly in the 70s, really find it really fascinating. And A&E came out of the kind of sci-fi tradition, and you know, lots of people have written about this, not very original by me, but rather than the wargaming tradition of kind of Gygax et al. So the APA was a amateur press association, was like a sci-fi kind of thing that people did. So when Lee Gold started it for the first time with role-playing, it was kind of an established thing. And yeah, so basically you might have a 60-page zine, of which was made up of 12 short mini zines, you know, and they might be. And one of the reasons I remember getting a hold of a copy of A&E in the 80s, and it like made no sense because most of it was about previous issues. So there'd be people saying, "Well, I think your thing about, you know, psionics in D&D was made no sense." And of course, you haven't read the thing about psionics in the previous issue, so it was complete nonsense. I sort of picked it up and wanted dungeons and character classes, but it was just people talking to each other about the game, and at a point where people were working out what that game was. So all the stuff about, well, this is how we do things in California, and it's different from New York, and it's different from the Midwest, and you know, you can't go to California and play in these people's dungeons because they play a completely different type of D&D. So you've got this sense of a game completely independent of what TSR and Gygax would want, a kind of game developing in terms of what actually are we playing here. So that APA thing where you had lots and lots of voices in the same issue, with Lee Gold really, really just stitching it together, was kind of unique, really. I think Troll Crusher, Brian Ansell's thing that he did, was an APA, but I haven't been able to get hold of any issues of that, so I don't know.
There were British contributors, but also, like the Dragon Lords, there's also kind of a opposition to Dragon magazine. It was kind of pushing against some of the, I suppose, the mainstream orthodox magazines that are out there.
Yeah, Dragon was a weird one. I got hold of, you can find Dragon magazine online if you look, you know. And if you look through the first 50 issues, there's almost like there's so little proper role playing material in it. Most of it's stories, most of it by Gygax, and cartoons, and you know, stuff, you know, kind of TSR news. But there's very, they didn't really publish dungeons. They didn't really publish, they didn't write about the game. They didn't write what it was like to play the game, or how you could play better. And I don't mean like systems mastery, but how you could like just be better at it in terms of a pursuit. So it was, I think, disappointing to a lot of people in the hobby who expected it to be kind of flying the flag a little bit more about, well, what's this hobby and what's this game going to be all about. In fact, it sort of did the opposite by Gygax, would sort of pop up every so often and just tell everybody to stop talking about the game and just, you know, keep buying it, but don't talk about it. You know, don't sort of think about what it could be, you know, just follow the rules. And he would occasionally write, you know, write letters to A&E basically telling everyone off, which of course had the opposite effect, as you would imagine.
And the other one that you've been looking back at is Dungeoneer.
I was amazed that Dragon took so long to, you know, TSR took a long time to think they could make money out of dungeons and modules and things like that, only really after Judges Guild started doing it. And Dragon took ages. They didn't, it had been going for like years before they started publishing dungeons, and it was very reluctant. So Dungeoneer was the first real magazine of any kind to pretty much to publish a dungeon and basically make kind of hardware, as we used to call it, the main point of the magazine. So a Dungeoneer would have a reasonably big dungeon, and then some, yeah, the usual monsters and character classes and things like that, spells and things. And if you, what's interesting to me, and it's done by the person who then went on to write Caverns of Thracia, which is a kind of a big sort of early example of, you know, a great dungeon that was became a template. And you can see in those early ones in Dungeoneer that literally working out, well, how do you write a dungeon? Like, how do you structure it? Like, you know, even things like, you know, how do you like number rooms and how do you indicate certain things? And you can see them over the 4 or 5 issues, just working out what's the best way to do what we obviously take for granted. But actually, they're really solid. I haven't run any of them, but you could stick Old School Essentials on them and run them today, and be perfectly happy. And the use of space and the use of sort of three-dimensional space and like unusual maps and things like that, that would sort of confuse players. And it's not just, you know, three kobolds in a room. You know, it's got a proper like ecology, you know, of actually why are these things here and how do they interact with each other when the adventurers aren't around. So given that it was 1976, because they just assumed that, well, if you want to make a dungeon, then just roll it up randomly. Why would you ever buy one? But I think Dungeoneer proved that it was pretty successful, proved that actually people wanted a bit more than just random dungeon creation.
And back in the day, you were a fanzine editor.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought one of your fanzines. Runestone was one.
Oh,
of
yes. Yeah. Well, you mean at the time or recently on eBay?
No, I at the time, and I've kept it as well. It's one I picked up at Dragon Meet when I went down to London
Okay. Which issue was it out of interest?
It's the one with, I can't remember the number, it's a green one with a duck on the front. Hudson Shaw used to do lots of ducks, didn't he, for fanzines back then?
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, quite a few of them were ducks. And I've got issue 3 here, which is before I got involved. And it's, I was leafing through it earlier and I came across what's maybe one of my earliest contributions, a letter in the letters page. It's fascinating. In issue 1, you mentioned articles on Call of Cthulhu. And apart from reviews, nothing has appeared. Please print something, as I've just bought a set and I'm in desperate need of material. Given that it's published in issue 3, so he's only done issue 1 and issue 2, and I'm moaning that he hasn't done very much on Call of Cthulhu, that's been unreasonable. But so I have no idea how it came about, but Bill Lucas was the editor, just invited me to be co-editor, I think. I'd never met him. I don't think I ever met him or ever even spoke to him. Like, it was all letters, you know. Nobody cares about this, but I probably started contributing maybe the back end of 84. And that makes me think that when I was launched my own things, that would have been like in 85, 86. I kind of feel that sort of, I went to university in 88. So, and in the run up to that, I pretty much stopped. So I think I was sort of 85, 86, maybe 87 doing my stuff. And as I say, you know, a whole variety of different names, basically.
So you had one called Manic Depressive, which I'm pretty sure that I've got a copy of that somewhere as well.
Really? Well, I'm going to hassle you for photocopies in that case, because I definitely don't have that one.
Yeah.
There was Hyperactive. I don't know where all these names came from, like some medical sort of history rather than, I mean, nothing real about me. But Hyperactive was actually, I quite liked the APA thing that we were talking about earlier. So. I mean, given that I sort of went into journalism, I quite like the idea of gathering other people's material and sort of shaping it. So Hyperactive was an APA. And then I did about half a dozen issues of something called Iron Orchid, Michael Moorcock reference, which I've got a couple of copies of. And then I did like a collaboration with somebody else who was a very, very good editor called Jez Keane, who... And we did, I think, called Love in the Garden, which I don't know why it was called that. And we did a couple of issues of that. And, you know, I think by that point, the whole hobby was starting to kind of implode. People were falling out. People were closing fanzines in sort of a bit of peak. And also growing up. And a lot of these fanzines were about, like, teenage boys kind of finding their personalities with. And it's about as pretty as it sounds, you know, in terms of... And then, you know, and then putting it on A5 paper and for history to judge, you know, 40 years later or whatever. So it's quite scary looking back.
They're always seem to be hitting out at the Irvings, as they refer to them, as like the people who were, you know, unenlightened.
The phrase that you should at the time that you were meant to use, role gaming.
Which
was apparently... Absolutely different from role playing, Dirk. It's completely different, obviously. One of the interesting things was, though, that looking back and trying to think back, was that they became less and less interested in games. Like, this is like 85, 86. You know, you see people go to conventions, go to Games Day or whatever it would have been in those days. And not like, if they were playing games, they weren't owning up to it. Like, I was listening to Rockland Files about UK Expo, and you're playing all these games. That's kind of why you're there, yeah? Be it shopping, but you're there to play games. And then when you look at these fanzines and then what they talk about, and even when they go to conventions, they're just not, they're kind of basically drinking and pitching at each other. Then if they're almost like it's seen as a bit juvenile to actually like buy a rule book and learn the game and play it. Like, why would you? I'm sure, you know, obviously, lots of normal people were still out there playing games, but they're kind of hobbyists, despite all this argument about what to call it. I just got the impression, maybe not at the time, I think I'm back projecting, that they'd really kind of stopped playing. They sort of lost interest. And it's interesting that, with a few exceptions, those fanzine editors and the people around that fanzine scene don't seem to have come out of a deep freeze and like go to grog meets or something like that. I mean, I think Neil Hopkins was involved in Quasits and Quasars, and so I and there's the odd person like James Wallace was a fanzine editor and has now got is in the industry. But most people, actually, weirdly, with Mark Gascoigne, I would have thought that Mark Gascoigne would have been the one that was like least interested in the actual games. And of course, he's the one from the Dragons' point of view who perhaps made the most long term career. You can still go and get a signature off him at Dragon Meet, which I think is kind of great, really. But for most people, it seemed to be the games became increasingly uncool.
And what was the impulse for you? Because obviously you had all this involvement, and as you say, you continued having these multiple titles. What do you think was driving you to produce these things?
Back in the day, I was kind of quite keen to become a journalist. There was a few things. One is that I remember you were, saying when you were talking about fanzines on the podcast, like, why would anybody want these character classes? Like, surely no one used them. And of course, like, no one did. But the great thing was that it would, whenever you saw a character class or you saw a dungeon for the first time, you think, I could do that. I could create one of those. I don't need your beekeeper character class. I can create my own animal juggler character class. So it inspires you to get down on paper all that crazy imagination stuff that you first got when you were 9 or 10 and just looking at the Dungeon Master's Guide for the first time and thinking, like, wow, where do I even start with this? You read DMG now, it's kind of completely tedious, but when you're young, it's just amazing. So having a forum for putting that down, sharing it, it's almost a point. You don't care that anybody uses it or not. It's just, I mean, it's a bit like Torch Bang now. If a few people buy it, then great. But it's mostly just about the joy of kind of creation and then moving into, that slightly embarrassing thing of like getting into music and then wanting to share that and into different other film and sort of thinking, I guess you are becoming a bit more sophisticated and wanting to share that. So you can see a lot of that is about, I've discovered this, I want to tell you about it, and also kind of show off a bit and just, as I say, kind of try do that sort of teenage thing of trying out new personalities, I guess, not consciously, but
So your new fanzine that you're releasing on Drive-Thru
and on RPG Trader as well, that new thing as well. Right. So
how would you describe it?
The tagline is role-playing games ancient and modern. So, well, it was kind of three things. One, probably the least sort of important, was I wanted to a forum for doing new gaming material like modules. I'd started selling stuff on Drive-Thru previous summer, and it was a good challenge for me to try and get a couple of things on Drive-Thru every month. So it was quite a decent challenge. And some things are, they're sort of best done in a fanzine rather than a standalone kind of product. So, and they're all, a couple of quid each. So it was a forum for that. But mostly it was partly moving from a shelves full of unplayed games that I bought on eBay or Kickstarter. And in 2024, I decided, right, my hobby should not be buying stuff and putting it on a shelf. My hobby should be playing. And I was playing very little because I didn't really have a face-to-face group. So I sort of plucked up the courage to start to do online with Raspy Raven, Grogmeet as well, and ran my first game for strangers at Virtual Grogmeet at the end of 2024, which was a real game changer. And then I set myself a target, big target sort of person, 100 games in 2025, which I achieved. I'll probably do 150 this year. So the byproduct of that is that I had to get down all these games and learn how to use them, whether I was running or playing them, And, you'd have something that you bought on eBay, like something really quite pretty, and you'd bought it and really wanted it, and then you hadn't even opened it. So getting Bushido down, like sometimes there were often games I used to own, like Bushido or what have I got here, Quest World or Golden Heroes, Psy World, Paranoid, and trying to work them out. Yeah. And some of Torchbound is really just going through some of these games and say, what's weird about them? What's interesting about them? If you look at, a whole bunch of pulp games from the 1980s, what do they have in common? Where do they work? What do they, that thing obviously got picked up by other games because it's quite common now. Getting under the hood of all these things. And there's some, you know, weird and wonderful things. I mean, mostly my shelves are sort of 70s, 80s, or last 20 years. I haven't got much 90s stuff because I've got no... I don't really like it very much. There's no nostalgia value. So Torchbound was about partly about trying to really use that material and write about the material and get sort of value and imaginative value out from it. And then probably the other thing is not so much the games themselves, but what we were talking about earlier in terms of fanzines and game culture. And I think, and fanzines are much better at giving you a picture of games, like games culture, than pro magazines. Like the other day I was looking through all my Imagine magazines. I used to really like Imagine when I was a kid, but they're sort of boring now because basically they're reviews, a couple of scenarios, and sort of industry news. There's nothing really on, and then lots of introductions to D&D if it's the you just bought the game for your birthday or something. But there's nothing, it doesn't tell you anything about what gameplay was like then, in a way that a pod like the Grognard Files, if you listen back to it 20 years from now, as I'm sure people will, it'll give you an insight, won't it, into what gaming was like. And if it was completely different in 20 years, people would be really fascinated by it. But Imagine doesn't give you that. Dragon doesn't give you that. White Dwarf does a bit. But the fanzines really, really do. So I was interested in using Torchbound as a way to say, how has the way we play changed, and how does some fanzines like Dragon Lords and other ones kind of capture that in a way that would otherwise be completely kind of lost. You know, there's no other, I mean, there's a few photographs from Games Fair and that's about it, really. There isn't, you know, that on people's memories. It's just a weird time when people were working out, as I say, what this game is all about.
So where can people find Torchbound?
Well, you can type in drive-through RPG, you can type in Torchbound, or you can type in Nick Edwards, and then you'll see other stuff that I've done. It's all quite basic, and some of the early stuff, like from a year ago, is super basic. At least I'm using Affinity now, but it's all little modules and stuff like that. So you can get Torchbound there, special price on the early issues, and then, or you can go to that new site that I found out about a few weeks ago, which is RPG Trader, which seems to be more sort of indie and sort of OSR-y. I get the impression. Have you come across that RPG Trader?
No.
Yeah. So it's I don't know. It's on, you know, people. Some of the Cairn guys, I should say, put a lot of stuff up, and some of the other British sort of somewhat indie creators have started to. I suppose it feels a bit more of like a scrappy underdog to drive through. But again, if you type in either my name or Torchbound, you can get it there. And I don't print it. I think print on demand is a sort of witchcraft I haven't got my head around quite yet. So I might at some point. You know, who knows, we might have some kind of, like, a few years from now, then Dragon Meat might have some kind of huge fanzine stand like it used to in back in the day. But
yeah.
And I should say to people, you know, there's some really, really fantastic magazines like Weird Science and Secret Passage, Nevermind the Dire Shoals. They are like sort of proper amateur magazines with art and contributions. Mine is just, you know, me writing and my son doing the cover. So it's very amateur, but I enjoy doing it.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed reading it because obviously it furrows similar ground than as we do on the podcast. And yeah. I've enjoyed your musings on some of these. It's great, great analysis, Nick, so thanks for doing that.
No, thank you. Well, thanks for letting me talk about it.
Starburst Memories!
Welcome to the Zoom of Role-Playing Rambling. I've got Blythe with me. Hello there, Blythe.
Hello, Doug.
I've invited you via Zoom into Sunday night in the den. And I remind you last time we were doing about fanzines, and we've been talking about fanzines with Nick Edwards. I want us to go back to fanzines, and we're going to look at some of these letters that we've had. But you know what? I think we should have a look at the issue of White Dwarf that was out in July 1983 in this period.
Wow, yeah.
The one with the the Stonehenge in the background and the chariot races, isn't it?
Yeah,
the heads on the chariots.
Yeah, issue 43. I remember this arrived whilst we were still at school, so the summer holidays hadn't started. It's like ahead of us, you know. We had our big plans because I'm sure it was going to be a rip roaring summer.
It was a rip roaring summer. Weirdly, I did a weird drunken experiment a while ago where I got it into my head that all the summers in the '80s were all glorious. When we were at college and stuff, they were all glorious summers. And I did a bit of research into summers in the northwest of England. And it's true that 1983 apparently was a scorcher. It was a hot summer, as was 84. But then it just goes downhill. 86 and 87, 88 were terrible, apparently. Were proper washouts. In my imagination, though, all summers in the 80s were brilliant. But they weren't. Apparently, they weren't.
So it all comes down to this year, really, doesn't it? So
This year. Yeah, apparently, 83 was a warm summer. So the internet, I could be wrong, couldn't it? It seems to correspond with our memory of hot summers. So, yeah, and it was also a summer. It was like a peak of role playing, and it was a summer between school terms. So 84 was a bit different because we left school, didn't we? So that had certain anxieties about jobs and college and what, you know, your mum and dad going, well, what are you going to do now? You know, that kind of
thing. Yeah.
Whereas 83 was almost the perfect summer for role playing because it there's no pressure to jobs, was there? Because you were going back to school in September. So you had that 6 weeks. And that by that point, role playing had reached a kind of, it's a zenith, hadn't it? It really had kind of taken hold of us because we've been playing for about 2 years. And at that point, it was just complete. I mean, I'm not saying it's an obsession now. but by that point, it was a real obsession, you know. And you had the summer, didn't you? I'm finishing school in a week or two. Don't have to go back for 6 weeks. Don't have to worry about anything.
According to this issue, though, and we probably weren't conscious of this when we were reading it, but Ian Livingstone is putting the feelers out there that actually most games companies now have started to turn their attention to the burgeoning microcomputer area, and that computer games are going to be the order of the day going forward.
And we would have probably glossed over that. We would have thought, I can't see that happening. How could anyone not want to play these games?
This was the year that the Dragon's Lair hit the arcade. Do you remember the animated coin-operated game?
Oh, yeah.
And it made the news. I remember making the news because it kind of blended together the idea of Dungeons & Dragons and this coin-operated thing that was...
Was that the one where you were in a little maze and you were like a wizard or a...
It was the one where it was an animated, it was like a cartoon where you played like a blonde adventurer.
There was one we played when we went on holidays to Morecambe. There was one in the arcade, wasn't there? And you played like a little wizard or a thief.
Yeah, I think that was Gauntlet.
Gauntlet, that's it. Yeah, Gauntlet.
This will help you remember. I'm gone. Put it in the chat.
Oh, yeah. I do remember it now, yeah.
It was very hard to find. They had one at RIL, but there was always, like, people who were crowded around it. But it seemed very limited what you could do. I mean, I went on it once or twice and were killed in the first, like, 2 minutes. But that's the story of my life when it comes to computer games.
Well, yeah. That editorial by Ian Livingstone talks about computer games, but we weren't really that interested in computer games, at least not as a replacement for role playing. We played computer games, as we've talked about before, haven't we? Like Manic Miner and stuff like that. But I don't think we saw them as a replacement. I don't think we ever saw them as something where we thought, oh, right, okay, we're playing these now, and eventually we'll just move on to it all being done by a computer. And I certainly never have. I've never, ever really got into computer games at all, ever. Not, you know, PlayStation,
Xbox, all that kind of stuff, even on a computer. There's very, very little. I think I've played Medieval Total War. That's the only one I ever played.
You do a bit of Backstreet Driving, though, don't you, with your daughter playing Baldur's Gate?
Well, I've recently done the Backseat Driving with Baldur's Gate, yeah. The old, like, for God's sake, cast Fireball, what are you doing? Well, that's only recently. I mean, again, I find it quite odd, really, that I've never been interested in them. Because there's obviously overlaps, but just don't do it for me.
There's overlap, but it's too much like hand-eye coordination, isn't it? It's not to do with imaginative stories, is it? It's more to do with...
Yeah.
It might get a bit of puzzle solving in there, but more likely it is to do with just like knowing what you're doing when you're pressing buttons, and I've never been very good at that.
Yeah, well, it's a skill. I think, yeah, it's a skill that you develop, isn't it? That you, if you persevere with it, you would get better at it. But can you be bothered persevering with it, isn't it? Can you be bothered spending a few months getting to grips with it? I can't bother. So that's probably the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Ian Livingstone saw it as the future. And maybe he was right to some extent. For his company, you know, if you read Diceman, like a lot of companies, they just overstocked on material. You know, they saw it as the future and just went too far. You know, they like that. It was hyped, but
yeah,
fell off, mainly because of piracy, I think. It never met the heights that they were anticipating at that time.
Yeah, it's going to come later, but not right then.
DD Miles.
So this issue then, if people should know the contents, there are some in there that are classics, aren't they? Because things like Happy Landings is probably, it sticks in the imagination.
They do, until you start reading these things. And I think that's the weird thing about old White Dwarfs, that I will sometimes cast my eye over them with a little warm, nostalgic glow and think, oh, it's good, wasn't it? But then you start reading these things and think, okay. So the Happy Landing one is quite funny because I think I remember, you know, I kind of hoovered up all traveller stuff. I was always looking for traveller stuff in White Dwarf because there was quite a bit, but there wasn't as much. I mean, it probably came... Did it come second, do you think, to D&D Traveller? And then RuneQuest was a poor third, maybe. Looking at this, you think, oh, great, stuff about starports. And then it's like, talks at one point about how a vertical landing would use a lot more fuel. So you've got to bear that in mind, right? And would be pointless on low gravity worlds. And you think, oh, really? I thought you were going to give me like something about the spaceport bar or... But these places were like, and they're a bit more colourful. Instead, there's a whole paragraph on. Anyway, the amount of fuel required to manoeuvre two back from 100 planetary diameters is small compared to that required to lift the ship. In order to ease the burden of calculation, it can be taken as 1/10 of the fuel remaining, that is 2 tons. This leaves 18 tons to take off and land vertically, or 9 tons for each three. What? Come on. Really? That typifies my experience with traveller then. That I was always looking for it. You're always looking for some exciting sci-fi stuff.
Apart from
the fact you think, is that true? I don't know. Even if it is true, why are you worrying about that? Who's worrying about that, really?
It was the floor plans though, isn't it, that may not even read it, but something about, oh, look at these plans. They look, the plans oversell it a little, don't they?
They do. And I think when I read it, I was drawn to the plans and thought the plans were quite good because at least they give you a depiction of what a starport might look like with the kind of landing pads and the landing bays and that kind of thing. You know, I think I might have used some of this in games to kind of describe what these places are like. So it's good from that perspective, but some of the bits in it give her a bit more exciting than this. More maths, more calculations. Right, well, we're landing on the starport. Well, you're going to land vertically. Well, when you'll find then that a lot of your fuel, just let me get my calculator,
We should look at Open Box. And what is notable about this issue is that it reviews Warhammer.
It does. It reviews Warhammer.
First edition.
Yeah. And I remember buying it. I bought it.
I think we both bought it because it's quite reasonable, wasn't it? Quite reasonably priced.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Bit disappointing, I think, if I'm honest. It was disappointing. And I think we both tried to get excited about it and tried to think it was good, even though it was not very good at all, really. It was a bit thin, I thought.
And of course, you've got the classic Ziggurat of Doom, the adventure that comes with it.
Yeah.
I remember trying to do that. I think I made a model of a German motorbike and sidecar, and I put it on like a plasterboard covered in green sawdust that I'd nicked from my dad, who was a railway modeler. And I think I used that to try and do the Ziggurat of Doom, and with some books standing in for the Ziggurat. And I think we abandoned it fairly early on because we thought, this isn't fun.
Yeah, it wasn't quite what we were expecting.
Bad start on that. And of course, that's why Warhammer failed, isn't it? Ultimately, that's why it never caught on, did it?
It never caught on, no. It's not like it's popular or anything now, is it?
Yeah.
No, I don't know what happened to it.
Our decision was mainly based on stuff falling over because I'd made this board with plaster on that was an uneven surface for the stands to go on. So they kept falling over. And that just frustrated me. And we never had enough for like a unit, did we? We had stand-ins for in these miniatures.
Yeah. I think as well, we just weren't interested in that kind of gaming either. I think that was a big part for me. I think there was a little bit of, they tried to tag on a little bit of a role-playing element, didn't they, where you could have individual characters with some kind of very, very vague stats. But it wasn't a role-playing game, and therefore we weren't that committed to it, were we?
The other thing that was reviewed here was Quest Worlds. I think we've documented elsewhere that I fell out with that quite quickly because it persuaded me to buy it and bought it that summer.
It persuaded you to buy it, but it only got a 6. It's quite strange, and it persuaded you to buy it, but it only got a 6 out of 10. It's not a great, it hasn't got a great review, is it? Some bits, it's a bit patchy when you read it. You kind of have a bit of a go at some bits of it. You think, okay, not that great, but again, maybe we didn't really read White Dwarf. Just loads of the pictures.
And also reviewed in the Tribes of Crane, which I think we've covered previously. We were never going to sink our hard earned pocket money into.
Oh no, they sat in our chairs.
There's an arms talk, isn't there, about RuneQuest and weapons.
And did we talk about anything else but arms talk in RuneQuest? I mean, I think...
You read it, and I find it's fascinating, isn't it? That at the time, I think we would have read that article and been completely absorbed in some of the stuff that they're talking about. So they're talking about weapons break in RuneQuest very easily. They're not designed to parry. That's why they break. And, maybe you could say a sword hasn't broken. It's just blunt and can still be used as a club, or it's bent and you can spend the melee round kind of unbending it, when he talks about Nordic kind of sagas where this happens and is accounted and all this kind of thing. Then he talks about armor taking a battering and breaking and all this kind of thing. At the time, we would have read that and been entranced by it. Thought, oh yeah, I like that. That's great. I read it now and think, for crying out loud. So that this seems realistic. Some comment, this seems realistic. You think, does it though? Is any of it realistic? I don't know. You're trying to make it realistic, but is it realistic? I'm not sure it is. Impales doing full damage, but it says, I would suggest that the edged weapon still gets stuck in the victim's body on specials 20%, but not on criticals.
Yeah, but I remember this being very controversial, this, because I think it meant that we were challenging the rules, and it offered a bit of ambiguity into it where we would think, are we doing it right? And we've spoken at length before, haven't we, about specials, the nature of specials. And are we doing it right? Do we ignore armour in this situation? Or is it double damage or double road damage? Or, and we still have those debates now.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Those things still go on, don't they? But I found it quite funny, a funny article, because I do think my perspective has completely changed, where at the time I would have read it very earnestly and thought, good point. And I would imagine we would have discussed this at length, wouldn't we? And possibly had quite heated debates about
definitely
what was good and what was bad in it, you know.
Because he tries to resolve the critical impale paradox.
Critical impale paradox. Some people are trying to find a cure for cancer or split the atom and do all sorts of things, aren't they? Well, people have split the atom. I know that. They've done that. That was a bad example. That's been done. But, you know what I mean? People are trying to find all these things. We're still worrying about this. That's why you're not a penny whistle, you know, master, because you spent all your time worrying about critical impales.
But what it did, I'm still quite angry about it. It kind of muddied the waters, this, because far from trying to, it didn't resolve the issue, because we'd all read it. Everybody became a bloody expert on the rules of this. And we tended to fluctuate between the two. His ruling and the ruling as we interpreted it in the book. And so, yeah.
Well, it was the eternal problem that a 20%, the 20% of your skill gets you an impale, whereas, was it 5% got you a critical? But the impale always felt better. The impale always was more deadly, wasn't it? And the critical, that was the problem. That's the problem we always wrestled with.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But it shouldn't feel like that, because surely the 5% one is going to be the better one. But, you know.
And people, you may say it doesn't really matter, but like I say, when we're playing with Eddie, we still have this discussion to this day. It's like nearly 50 years later that we're having this.
But I think what's funny about it is we were very sniffy about RuneQuest, weren't we, the best role-playing game. And I was slightly envious that because of the Prime Directive, you had it, I couldn't buy it, I had to play it, I couldn't run it. And yet we all agreed it was the best role-playing game out there. It was better than Traveller, it was better than D&D, it was better than all of them. And yet, even though it was so good, we just spent our time arguing about these rules that it wasn't so good because we couldn't get to the bottom of the bloody rules.
It was very controversial for us, but in the letters pages that came after this issue, it was actually Lewis Pulsifer's article that drew all the heat, because he suggested that it may be possible to have somewhere that sold magical items.
That's right. There is an article about that, isn't there? Yeah. And Magimart.
Magimart, yeah. But it was in this atmosphere of people were transferring characters from campaign to campaign. So this idea that you would have different bunches of friends where you took your character along to participate in a dungeon. And really the article is really just how to adjudicate that, how to deal where it had some hard and fast rules of saying, no, you shouldn't allow people who have purchased items in a campaign that's different from your own. But it's perfectly legitimate for people to purchase things within your campaign. So, you know, they have to give up those items at the door.
Which I think at the time would have seen a very weird article to us, because, of course, we didn't. We had the Prime Directive, so there's no way you or Eddie or Simon could transfer a RuneQuest character into my game because you ran a RuneQuest. Yeah. So that didn't happen. And, of course, we didn't know anyone else who played. So, again, that seemed a strange thing, that people would go to another group or go to another. They'd rotate being Games Master and go, well, I want to bring my 8th-level paladin into your campaign now. That would have seemed odd to us.
Inadvertently, Lewis Pulsifer comes up with some cracking ideas for scenarios, because he asked the question that if you did have a bring and buy sale for plus one swords, why isn't it being raided every 5 minutes?
Well, I was just going to say that. That's the problem with it, isn't it? Your players would just burgle the place. I mean, people would just rob it, wouldn't they? Steal all the magic items. Oh, you magic cloak of invisibility. It's 5,000 gold pieces. Oh, we go, all right. But we are adventurers. We are like murder hobo adventurers. We just go and rob it, steal it, wouldn't we?
But yeah, where else are you going to offload those experience points that you've accumulated? It's a good issue. It's, of course, got part two of Irelion, and it's probably the reason why this issue stays in my imagination, because it has the illustration of somebody pouring the contents of their chamber pot onto somebody's head.
Right. Yeah. And in a way, that's the centre. I mean, it is the centrepiece of the issue, but it's also, even though we didn't play at the time, it's probably the best thing in it, isn't it? I mean, the map's great and they're building this huge city and all that kind of stuff. It probably is the best thing in it, even though at the time we would have, you know, not played it because it was AD&D.
So in this issue, there's a letters page, and in that letters page, we have the ongoing argument that's taking place about the necromancer class. And if you want to see more detail of that, you need to listen to Daily Dwarf's examination of that in our D&D episodes. But yeah, it went on for a while, that, didn't it? This idea of whether player characters should be necromancers.
Yeah, it's kind of odd character class to play, wouldn't it? But
ignore this. It's a rug covering a hole.
Let's return to our letters page, or as we call it, Thunder page, where we get readers' letters to our imaginary fanzine. It doesn't exist. It just exists in your imagination.
Best place for it, to be honest.
And it is Torquemada's Doom. And this is still the first issue of Torquemada's Doom. And we've got some more letters from our Grog squad. So here we go. Are you ready for another?
Go on.
Dear Dirk and Blythe, what is your favourite issue of White Dwarf so far this year? What films have you been to see at the cinema that have inspired your RPGs? And also, do you think that Rebecca Stapleton will be going to the school trip this year to Llandudno? Yours faithfully, John R.
My favourite issue is 43. No one just looked at. There you go.
Yeah, that makes it easy, doesn't it?
Fresh in my mind. Yeah, it's very easy to answer that. Yeah.
It was a cracking year, though, that year for White Dwarfs. I think it's probably at its peak for me.
Yeah, it did feel like that. It felt like we were reaching a kind of peak with role playing, both of being into it, as I said, for a couple of years. But yeah, White Dwarf as well was kind of hitting its stride, really. What films did we see?
Well, that year, of course, was 1963, is the year of Return of the Jedi. It come out to the cinema, yeah.
Well, that's funny, isn't it? That I wouldn't have. I don't know, the Star Wars films were pushed a bit earlier. They're a bit pushed earlier 80s, but you know, you're right. Return of the Jedi.
We're going to do a Star Wars episode. We keep promising this, don't we? Didn't we said this?
We're a bit frightened of it.
We're a bit frightened of doing it. But one of the reasons is the ire of the fans. And I remember when Return of the Jedi came out, there was a lot of people who were very upset about the fact that there was a lot of Muppets in it, as they refer to them.
Yeah, there was a lot more Muppets, wasn't there, in Jabba the Hutt's palace, that lots of, yeah.
Which I think is brilliant. One of the best scenes in the entire run of Star Wars, isn't it, the Jabba the Hutt's palace?
It is now, though, isn't it? It is now. You know, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? At the time, I think people were taken aback by what's all this, you know, with Salacious Crumb, isn't it? The kind of weird thing on his shoulder.
Yeah.
I think,
but you're right. Now it's a kind of iconic, isn't it? That scene with Princess Leia chained up and all the weird aliens and everything. Yeah.
Is it because it kind of opened up the universe to say that actually there's a lot more going on?
Yeah. I think that's part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, people objected to the Ewoks at the time. I remember the Ewoks coming in, like the teddy bear thing. But again, I thought that was great.
Yeah, well, I think what Return of the Jedi did, I suppose, it introduced lots of aliens, didn't it? Whereas Star Wars, you had the scene in the bar in Star Wars, I suppose, lots of aliens in that. But it's only a very relatively short scene, isn't it? And then The Empire Strikes Back has aliens in it. You know, it has the Admiral Ackbar and things like that. But they're a bit more.
Well, I think when he gave a sense of it,
they spread a bit thinner in the other films, I think.
Yeah, well, Endor was a populated place, wasn't it? It felt like a different place to Tatooine, which it spent most of the place. And the other places that you've seen, like Cloud City and Yoda's place, what's it called? Deborah, whatever it's called. What's it called?
Dagobah.
Dagobah, yeah. I could never pronounce it.
This is why we don't want to do a podcast on it. Can't remember.
But yeah, you never got the sense that they were like fully functioning ecosystems. But that's what Return of the Jedi did. Well, it kind of created this space that had living community on there, a different culture that was represented with these Ewoks that you kind of soon got introduced to. And they were quite innocent, but under threat from the Empire, weren't they, in this Death Star that was being built.
We've been waiting for a long time. So when was The Empire Strikes Back released?
Yeah, so Empire Strikes Back was 1980.
And Star Wars was Super Star Wars 77,
but we were... 77, we would have probably seen it the year later because it took a while for it to be distributed, didn't it?
Yeah. The late 70s, very early 80s is that's what it started. I'm sort of slightly surprised that Return of the Jedi was in 83, but yeah.
Have we got a view on Rebecca Stapleton going to the school trip to Clan Dodnor?
I think she will. But I don't want to raise John's hopes.
Really. Yeah. It's not going to be interested.
Yeah. Find out you play role playing games. That's the end of that.
You seem to be very obsessed with this RuneQuest game and its skill based rules. But why are you not planning to include more bunnies and burrows materials in your fanzine? It was the first game with a skill system. I'm flabbergasted. You will be not giving it your due respect, and I can only conclude that you have completely misread the hobby and your fanzine will not sell well at all, Brian D.
The reason we're not going to include a talk, if we don't talk about bunnies and burrows, is because it's bunnies and burrows.
I've become very open-minded, as you know, Blyden. I think of the two of us, I have probably got the open mind, haven't I? I'm probably the one.
Well, hang on a minute. You don't even say you're open-minded. Well, I'm a kind of bigot. Hey, steady up.
No. When it comes to gaming, you've got an idea of what you like, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Whereas if somebody comes up with something, which of the two of us is more likely? Yeah, go on, I'll give that a go.
Yeah, you're more likely to play Bunnies and Burrows than me.
I don't think I would, though. This is what I'm saying.
No.
I'm taking the stand. I think when it comes to these animals as human games, I'm still a bit... I'm not convinced by them.
Like ducks in RuneQuest.
I think we've had this discussion, haven't we, before. I am still appalled by the idea of the duck. Even though... Even though 10 years of being assimilated into, they're part of the culture, you know, it's a good joke, and is it a joke, and it's fake, and all that. I just still think it's a bit daft having talking badgers and stuff like that. I just do. And the idea of having play characters who were mice, it's something I would avoid.
Mm. I think I'm a little more open to the idea, really. I don't mind ducks in RuneQuest. I don't mind the mallards in Dragonbane. I think you're gonna run Dragonbane, aren't you, soon? I'm thinking of playing a mallard in it. I think it's quite good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't mind it. I think there's possibly a difference between a fantasy game that has animal based. So RuneQuest has got its baboons and it's got its ducks. Daltonwood has got its grimalkins, hasn't it? The cat people. And it's got Breggles who are like goats. So you've got a bit of that. I don't mind that, but I know what you mean. The idea of a game where...
Yeah, so the idea
everybody in it.
Yeah.
It's like Beatrix Potter on speed or something. Beatrix Potter with broadswords. I'm not having it. Yeah, I do know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're a team of crap budgerigard. We're all budgerigard.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. 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 I know what you mean.
Bunnies and budgerigards. We're a crack team. We're going to break out of this cell and we're just a cuttlefish and go out on adventures.
Yeah. And defeat the evil cat overlords who would eat us for breakfast. Literally, it's breakfast.
Don't count me in.
No, I
skills based or not.
Could be the best system in the world, but I'm afraid there's more to games than the system, isn't there?
Yeah.
Are you going to make me play a rabbit in a rabbit world full of rabbit people?
I'm not saying that people should stop playing it.
Be clear.
Don't want a
controversy on our hands, do we?
Yeah, if you enjoy playing rabbits, you go ahead and play rabbit.
You do it.
Otters, badgers, any mammal or bird or a lizard.
A reptile.
I'm counting out no.
Insects.
So, yeah, bunnies and burrows. I'd never have picked it up because I just wanted to play rabbits.
We wouldn't have picked it up. But in a way, your opinion now is immaterial to the fact that at the time, we would never have picked it up because we were quite sniffy and poor-faced about it. So we wouldn't have entertained it then anyway. But sorry about that. Sorry about that, Randy. That's our view.
Well, how many skills have you got as a rabbit?
I mean, it says it's skill-based, but what skills? How many skills have we got as a rabbit?
Detect carrots.
Run away.
Dodge tyres.
Dig burrow. Appear from top hat. I don't know. What skills have you got? I mean, you say skill based, but what? Spot predator. Maybe about five or six skills you need as a rabbit.
To me, you could do a Powered by the Apocalypse game, couldn't you? Because there's lots of humping involved as a rabbit.
And this is why we must never play a game where people play animals. There we go.
This is from California. Dear Dirk and Blithey, this might not make any sense to you now, but the machine worked. And on the night, I go back in time to 1983 at 1:30 a.m., a cell group dedicated to a currently unpublished game called Rifts will try and stop you. Please take whatever precautions are necessary and prevent this terrible disaster. Unfortunately, the plan is to stop Palladium Fantasy Roleplaying failed, and the calculations were off and I arrived too late. So good luck, lads. I hope you enjoy a lot of acronyms. Your friends, Kelvin Klein. P.S. I still can't believe you made a time machine out of a Triumph TR6. So again, this is off our... We need somebody to bring us into the world of Palladium games because there's a whole world out there, Blithey, that has been untouched by us that we need to discover. Because I've heard Palladium, obviously, we've talked about it and we've had guests on talking about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I always have to stop myself calling them Hero Turtles because the BBC bolderized them. Yeah. In the UK, they were known as Teenage Hero Turtles, even though they referred to themselves as Ninja Turtles because of some strange resistance to them being called ninjas
I think it was because there was a view that ninjas were assassins, and therefore assassins was is not suitable for children.
Yes. In the same way that they renamed Top Cat Boss Cat, even though he referred to himself as TC and Top Cat, but the BBC called him Boss Cat because there was a brand of cat food called Top Cat.
There was a brand of cat food, yeah. And of course, as a kid, I never understood that. I used to watch Top Cat, Boss Cat, and think, but people used to call it Top Cat, though, didn't they?
Yeah.
It was called Top Cat. When you saw the credits, it's Top Cat. It was just in the listings in the Radio Times. It said Boss Cat, didn't it? We're back onto Animal. Boss Cat, the role-playing game.
And sign me up for that.
You play? Oh, you're a hypocrite. You play that, wouldn't you? You play Benny the Ball. Benny the Ball, but you wouldn't play if you had a budget. The man is a hypocrite.
But we get distracted here from the main point, which is Palladium Games. So,
oh yeah, of course. Sorry,
we didn't play Palladium Games, but I do actually have a copy of Palladium, which one of the Grog Squad kindly provided to me. And I feel like we have to kind of explore this area because it's like it's an undiscovered country. From
the blind spot, really, isn't it?
The blind spot. And part of the eccentricities of this system was a thing called Rifts, which I have played. It's a setting for Palladium Games, which I have played, but for Savage Worlds. Steve Ray ran a game for me, and I do have all the stuff for Savage Worlds Rifts. So it's kind of infamous because of its kind of lack of balance, where you can play kind of very low powered characters to playing a dragon or these cyborgs that are the size of cities, and so there's kind of a strange power imbalance in your party. So I think a time machine to prevent that happening. Well, that'd be sad, wouldn't it? Because we wouldn't be able to discover it.
Complicated. In my head, I imagine it's very complicated.
It is complicated, yeah. I think it's like you need to have like a bit of a maths group to kind of work it out. Additionally, I think the rule book doesn't help you because there's no index or there's no logic to how it's presented. And it's become infamous because of that reason. And there are derived games like Champions and things like that use this system. But
No, I remember hearing about it at the time. I remember it, but I don't think. Did we ever see it for sale? Any?
I don't know.
Can't remember. I remember seeing adverts for it, I think, in White Dwarf. But if you didn't see it in Games Workshop or Odyssey 7, it didn't really exist, did it?
We're in the Den. And this is the place on a Sunday night. You've had a couple of beers.
Mm-hmm.
This is where you commit to projects that you come to regret later.
Of course, yeah. It's like this podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I feel that we should commit to, from 1983, this point we've spent here this evening in 1983, we should try and find out more about Palladium Games and run some and play some.
Seems like a trap, to quote Admiral Akbar. It's a trap.
It's a trap.
Well, you can run it and I'll play it. I'm quite keen to reintroduce the Prime Directive there. You can run Palladium Games and I'll just play it.
You'll play it. Okay.
I'll play it.
Yeah, just don't get bunnies and budgerigars. Cheers, Blady.
All right. Goodbye.
Never mind the dice rolls. At last, there's something to read. Campaign ideas. Reviews of both old and new games. And much, much more. This is the answer to the void that we have found. Find Never Mind the Dice Rolls on Patreon and DriveThruRPG.
Oh, get me caught! We're heading towards the end of the room, and we've been in this room for quite some time now, haven't we?
Mm.
longer than we anticipated.
It's always longer than we anticipated. You go off on a tangent. Which people might not, in the end, people might not hear when you judiciously edited this, you know.
I might put the offcuts in Dirk's dossier. So these kind of asides okay. We might use elsewhere for our patrons. But yeah, heading towards the door, it's time we really should be finished. But before we go, just a bit of closing time chatter. What's occupying in your mind at the moment? What are you up to?
Well, on Sunday next week, I will be running some Shadow Dart at MorpCon. So,
yeah, so MorpCon's the in-person.
Yeah, in-person Manchester thing every other month, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm running the Hell Pits of Nightfang, the General Jacquet's adventure, which we have played, I think. I think Eddie ran it. I'm not sure if we ran it back in the day. Eddie ran it a few years ago, so we might have played it twice. But
it's a Judge's Guild one, isn't it? It's a Judge's Guild.
It is, but it's been reinvented for DCC and 5th edition, hasn't it? So, you know. And it is, I mean, I know Judge's Guild have form for being a little bit, shall we say, put it politely, uneven. But it is. I think it's considered a bit of a classic. It's one of the better ones that they produced. You know, classic kind of vampire hunt dungeon, quite well put together. Weird in that it's originally it was for RuneQuest, wasn't it? But when you read it, if you read the DCC version or the 5th edition version, you can see there are bits of RuneQuest in there, but of course they're not RuneQuest. And I think the original was like that. I don't think it was set in Galantha, was it? But it had like alluded to Stormball and Thanatar and things like that, but it didn't name them, I don't think.
I think where Eddie revived it, he set it in Balazar, didn't he? It's part of Griffin Mountain campaign. Yeah. But yeah, I think he had to do some work, didn't he, to
The original was for RuneQuest, but it wasn't set in Galantha. So I'm kind of getting that ready at the moment and decided to do it for Shadow Dart because Shadow Dart's quite good, quite a nice little game. And it fits it well, you know, it fits that kind of adventure quite well. So I'm doing that. I played Shadow Dark. I've run it a couple of times and I've played it a couple of times. So quite looking forward to that.
I'm at the same event. I'm running a game of Cthulhu by Gaslight, which I'll come back to, but having MorpCon as a regular event now every couple of months is contributing to my current spate of games maxing. That's what I've been doing, Blythe. I've been games maxing.
Easy to do.
Well, it's just making sure. We always have said, haven't we, that when people say, how do you manage to fit so many games into your time? And the answer we always give is that we schedule the time and make sure that we turn up and
happens.
I think what we've found over the last 18 months, for various reasons, for the people that we play with and ourselves, that we're having to cancel things. And that was never our way, was it?
No, it wasn't really. No, a bit frustrating, I think. Things kind of getting in the way, life getting in the way of things, really. So, because you do have to make that. It's very easy to let things get in the way of it and cancel and postpone. And then, of course, you realise you're not doing very much. So, yeah. But MorpCon's a good way of having a face-to-face game every now and again.
Yeah. But also with the other games that we have scheduled, I've taken on the mantle of the megalomaniac that I am. And started to put a bit more discipline. So we've made sure that they're scheduled in until the end of the year and that we've got a bit of backup and extending them just to make sure that they run. Because I think you've got to make it happen, you've got to schedule it in, haven't you? And
to make it happen, you've got to do it. That's the thing. And I suppose as well, one of the tricks is have a big enough group to...
Yes.
If someone can't make it, even the, I mean, you've put across this idea, haven't you, where regular groups, if the GM can't make it, one of us could run a little one shot, which is quite a good idea. And you do hear of people doing that, you know, people who have regular face-to-face groups do that, where, yeah, you know, they meet on the third Thursday of the month, and if the GM can't make it, they'll have something that someone will run just for a bit of a laugh, kind of one-off.
It's to keep the momentum, partly to keep you making sure that you've got the rhythm of play, but also it's to make sure that everybody around you knows that you're playing on that particular time, because as soon as you get out of that rhythm, people start saying, oh, are you not doing that this evening? Oh, great. Well, I've got this you can do, or we need this doing. There's this taxi job that I need you to do. Somebody needs picking up.
It's true that you drop out of it, don't you? I mean, it's like our Wednesday group, isn't it? We play, we've had a Wednesday group every other Wednesday for a long, long time now.
Yeah.
And it's good because in the house, there's an assumption. Even though we play every other Wednesday, there's an assumption that on a Wednesday I'll be playing a game. So that sort of almost by osmosis fits into the family calendar almost, you know, oh, it's Wednesday. So, you know, whereas as you say, if you suddenly stop for a few months, then that Wednesday gets overtaken by other things, doesn't it? Other commitments, other assumptions and expectations that you're free and you're not doing a game, so you're free to do other things.
So I'm playing a Cthulhu by Gaslight at MorpCon, a scenario that I've written set in Manchester, Cottonopolis, at the height of its pomp when it was the centre of the universe, where all power was directed from Manchester across the world. Can you imagine such a utopia? One day it will rise again. But until then, you've got a chance to play in this Cthulhu game. And it stars Mrs. Gaskell, so Elizabeth Gaskell, who's a novelist based in Manchester, social reformer, and a literary person around town. And I started this now. I did it for good friends of Jackson Elias Weekend as online. But as I went into it, I thought the idea was undeveloped. And I made a bit of a mistake, because I'd written this scenario. And it was one of those, Blythe, where I'd submitted the pitch some time before I'd actually written it. And in the writing of it, it was taking me in a different direction to the pitch.
Yeah.
Has that ever happened to you?
It has, yeah. That's the danger.
Yeah. And the flaw I made was making it a Pulp Cthulhu, when all along it was just like a normal Cthulhu.
Yeah.
So it was hard, that first run through I've done of it. I'm going to have another go at it, because I think there's a good idea in there somewhere. But making it Pulp Cthulhu, it like raised the expectations that it wasn't, like we were saying last time, it was more of an adventure than horror event, and it kind of knocked the balance of it. Good. Right, so after Sunday night in the den, I think it's time we can call it good evening. Thanks all for joining me.
Goodbye.
There isn't another bit.
Okay, thanks to Nick for giving his time to talk about his old fanzine project and his new one. And you can find a link in the show notes to his new efforts. And you can also see some links to other fanzines that I think you might enjoy. I'm still out on my ramble somewhere on the border between Wales and England. And we've got a bit of lust. You know, these public footpaths, you know, it is a political act. Unknown armies have got it right. We've encountered quite a few electric fences along the way that we've had to scramble under. It's turned into kind of a dangerous adventure. Although we haven't encountered Boris Johnson as a clown prince yet. I want to say thank you also to our patrons who keep this show on the road. And we've had some new ones starting with us recently. So I'll give them some individual shout-outs next time. And I'm going to give them a virtual gift from the game that we will be covering. And that game will be Western Games, Price of Freedom. Until then, adios, amigos.